Good morning, everyone. Welcome back. This is House Fisheries Committee, and we will come to order at 10:11 a.m. Today is Tuesday, January 26, 2016. Members present are Representative Herron, Representative Foster, Representative Millett, and myself, Chair Stutes. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. We are also joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Matt Kern from the LIO, and my Fisheries Committee aide is Reed Harris. Today we have two bills on the agenda, House Bill 177, King Salmon Tags and Designs, and House Bill 220, Fish Enhancement Permits. First up is House Bill 177, King Salmon Tags and Designs. And would the sponsor please come up and put himself on the record and begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Representative Wes Keller, and I am bringing HB 177 before you. And I want to thank you. I think maybe it is for me, for sure, and maybe in the building. I think this is the first bill that is a fun bill with a little bit of a fiscal note that is being considered. It is the year of the budget. We're all very focused and concerned on those issues. So to bring forward a bill and for you to hear a bill that comes that is initially projected here at $48,000 a year, which is relatively small, nonetheless very significant in these tight times. It's a fun bill, and I'm going to let my staff explain what it does. And I just want to say that we're in negotiation, friendly negotiation, with the department on the fiscal note, and hoping that we can adjust it if it's appropriate. We're not asking for something that's not appropriate. But we have, I know, testifying today, somebody from Alaska Railroad. You've all seen the Alaska Railroad print, so I would suggest that the committee maybe find out what the fiscal impacts of making that that poster available is. And anyway, it's a fish stamp bill, and I'm going to let my staff explain more precisely what it does.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Keller. For the record, my name is Jim Pound, staff to Representative Keller. House Bill 177 is essentially a small step in assisting to maintain an important part of our economy, which is fishing. We look at every corner, we're nickeling and diming in the budget process right now. Fish enhancement is certainly an area that I'm concerned, and I think a lot of people are concerned that may end up getting some cuts. This could help. What's involved is an action part of the bill basically takes the Alaska King fishing stamp into the art community. It'll convert today's stamp from a plain to a rendition that'll find ways into artists and collectors' hands. In addition to the stamps, there'll be posters and art prints. Sales basically can be handled by boat operators, charter boat captains all across the state, and of course they'll be available in fish and game offices as well, and possibly online. The funds from these stamps and from the sales, and not so much from the stamps, but from the sales of the posters, additional funds can be, or at least a portion can go into the Fish and Game Fund as appropriated by the legislature. The winning artist would receive would release the work for 2 years, intellectual property as it's referred to. After that, it will return to the artist, the original art. The artist can sell it, put it on their wall, brag about it, or whatever they want to do with it after that 2 years. In a time that we're working for ways to save money, this is a way to enhance some income, I believe, in the fish and game department as for fish enhancement. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. As we said, we do have Stephanie Wheeler from the Alaska Railroad who handles the posters and the prints for the Alaska Railroad, and who is certainly much more has much more expertise on what's associated with actually doing the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from this committee? Representative Herron.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Jim, lines 11 and 12 may only consider designs submitted by state residents. Is that true of the duck stamp as well?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I believe it is, but Fish and Game is here. We should probably check with them. They can probably give us an exact requirement on that.
Okay. Fish and Game is in the room?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Could you step forward, please, Mr. Brooks? He's the deputy commissioner for Comfish. Good afternoon. Please state your name, or good morning. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Representative Stutes, members of the committee. Kevin Brooks, deputy commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. The question was, if I heard it correctly, is whether this residency requirement applies to duck stamps. And it's not a question I can answer off the top of my head, but certainly one that we can get back to the committee with information on.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, follow-up then. I mean, I really don't have an issue with this. It's just in Jim's testimony, there, you know, people come from all over the world to catch a king salmon, or at least fight with one, and so it just seems odd that we would preclude other artists from around the world that have an appreciation for our state salmon. And so, I mean, I really don't have a problem with this, but it just seems, why would we want to limit it to 736,000 people, the opportunity to design a stamp? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Please.
Through the chair, Senator Harris, I'm an old Fairbanks boy. And this is personal, and we've always gone to local hire as much as we possibly can, and I look at this as similar to being a local hire issue.
Thank you. Do we have any other in-house testimony on this? Oh, it would be on this. Huh? A new gadget. It does not appear as such. So, let's see. I will now... I'm looking at this. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm going to open. I'll now open public testimony, and please limit yourself to 3 minutes in your comments. And I would like to acknowledge Representative Christ Tompkins. Thank you. Okay, we have Stephanie Wheeler from the Alaska Railroad. Are you there, Stephanie?
I am. Hi.
Hi. If you could speak up just a little bit, maybe.
Sure.
And please state your name for the record.
My name is Stephanie Wheeler. I'm the Corporate Communications Officer for the Alaska Railroad.
And your testimony?
Actually, I was just trying to give some information on the Alaska Railroad's annual art print program. We do open that up to Alaska artists every year in November. We have a deadline for submission in mid-February. Artwork is selected in March, and then we contract with the artist for about $3,000, and they produce artwork that's due at the end of the summer, which gives us time to produce the posters for in time for the holidays, which is a popular sales time, and we hold some sign and sale events in November and December. As far as costs go, the hard costs for our program is right around the $20,000 mark. That includes production of 3,000 posters, 800 prints that are then signed and numbered by the artist, and some matching lapel pins. It also includes a little bit of advertising agency time, what we pay the artist, which again is $3,000, the cost for the sign and sale events, a little over $1,000, and then publicity costs, which is primarily advertising in three newspapers and on social media. So that's about $20,000. And then we have between 175 to 200 hours annually that are staff time by the Alaska Railroad staff. So costs overall run a little over $20,000, and we do bring in just about that amount, maybe a little bit over, between $20,000 and $23,000 every year, which offsets the cost. So it's not a moneymaker, but we do offset the cost. It's very popular amongst tourists and residents alike. We have people come back year after year reserving a particular print. I go out every year to those people and ask them if they want the same print. And there's enthusiasm amongst art enthusiasts and rail fans. So it's a good public relations program, and just another way to get the railroad's imagery out there on walls and in bedrooms and offices. So it's a very positive program for the railroad.
Thank you. We also have Tom Brookover from Alaska Department of Fish and Game for online for any questions, if anyone has any. Are there any further questions from this committee? Apparently not. Okay. Can I have a motion to move this bill from committee? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I do. I want to close public testimony first. So I shall close public testimony. I looked at that. And now I'd like to entertain a motion to move this bill.
Madam Chair, I move to send House Bill 177-29-LS0774/A from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Do I hear any objections? Okay, we will pass this bill out of committee.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Wes.
With that, we will take a brief at ease. Trees will be back on record. Next up is House Bill 220, Fish Enhancement Permits. We will hear a presentation by the bill sponsor and take public testimony, and then we will set this bill aside to a later date to allow for further public testimony. There's a draft committee substitute, 29LS1039N. May I have a motion to adopt version N as the working document?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt CS for House Bill 220-29-LS0709/N as a working document.
Thank you. Hearing no objections, I will object for further discussion. You can pick it up if you want. Would the sponsor please put himself on the record and explain the changes to the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And committee members, for the record, I'm Dave Tallarico. I'm the representative for House District 6. And would you prefer the changes, or we never have. This is the first chance to introduce the bill, so would you like me to?
Do you have an amendment for this bill?
We don't. With the committee substitute, if you've adopted that, that's your working document, so.
Brief at ease. Back on record. Thank you. Okay, well, we'll just go ahead and proceed then, please.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill. I don't think it's any surprise to anybody that you all know that one of our natural resources in the state of Alaska that provides us a substantial amount of food source and provides a lot of livings to people, and of course can be a very contentious issue, or fish. And I would like to start out as I was approached by several people, and they said, well, why would a guy from what they referred to as the dry zone, Healy, which is not exactly known as a hot spot for fishing, be interested in a fish enhancement bill? And just a brief geography lesson. From the village of Tanana all the way to the Canadian border is within my district. That's the portion of the Yukon River and its tributaries that are in there. Portion of the Kuskokwim River is in there, and of course Copper River is in the district. I don't want to tell you all the rivers that are in my district, but there's certainly a lot of opportunities there in Alaskan waters within the district. The main focus behind House Bill 220 is really to provide a tool to the Department of Fish and Game where I think there's a gap that Alaska can use to increase our fish populations. The permit allows organizations outside of the department and outside of what we currently do and the way we currently have our fish hatcheries set up to actually help us increase our fish populations, which also increases
our food resource, in particularly in those areas that I represent along the Yukon River, which was mostly my focus in coming up with the bill. We've also been very careful, and I appreciate the Department of Fish and Game working with us to make sure that we have very effective and appropriate controls and measures within the bill, so that it was described to me at one point in time that it's just a willy-nilly way to put fish in the river. And I think if a close inspection of the bill will show that really this falls under the auspices of the Department of Fish and Game. It will require people to come up with a project plan. It requires approval from the Department of Fish and Game. And I actually have a expertise sitting behind me that can explain a lot of those details much better than I can. So I really think that this bill benefits Alaska and Alaskans. If we can increase our natural fish populations using some of the latest technology that's available to us, I think we all benefit from that. So I will turn this over to people which are much more qualified than I to speak about increasing these fish populations. I do have with me my staff member, Joshua Banks. If you would like, he is certainly more than happy to do a sectional analysis for you.
Please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joshua Banks, staff to Representative Dave Tallarico. The version N that's before the committee is based on some initial concerns that the Department of Fish and Game had of the original bill that was introduced, and we hoped that the changes that were made in CS, and as I'm going through the section analysis, I'll explain where those changes are and how it differs from the original version. We hope that the changes made will address the concerns not only by the Department of Fish and Game, but also by some of the public public testimony that may have concerns about this bill. Starting with Section 1, it creates a new section in AS 1605 to create the new Fisheries Enhancement Permit. And subsection A sets the parameters for what this permit will be used for. First, it can be used to remove anadromous or freshwater finfish from a body of water, collecting the eggs and milk, or fertilizing and incubating the eggs, then placing the incubated or fertilized eggs or hatched fish in either the same body of water where the fish eggs were taken from or another body of water. And the second purpose of this permit is that it can be used to enhance habitat in Alaska water, such as removing a barrier for fish passage or rerouting a waterway for salmon to access spawning ground easier. One of the changes that was made in this section was in subsection 1, which says to remove anadromous or freshwater finfish. Originally, the bill just said fish. And according to statute, that includes any fish that swims in freshwater, saltwater, up to including amphibians. We wanted this to be focused more particularly on salmon, but also allow for trout, grayling, other fish that are popular with sport fish and commercial fishing. So that's the first change. The second change with this section, there used to be a subsection 3, which the intent was that a legislative legal put that third subsection in. The intent was to differentiate between this permit and the current hatchery permit that's in statute. But the way it was worded was a little confusing both to us as well as the Department of Fish and Game. And so instead of trying to figure out how it works into the bill, we just decided to cut that subsection, and the amendment that's in .1 has the same intent as what the former A3 had, but it's just a little bit more clear. And we can deal with that, Madam Chair, at whatever point you'd like to deal with that amendment. So then subsection B of 1605-855 states that what an applicant will need to provide with the application for this permit. It includes simple things such as the applicant's name, a fee of $100, the locations of where the fish will be taken from and where the fish will be put back into the water, whether it's the same body of water or a different body, and the number, the species of fish and the number of fish that will be taken, as well as if any will be used for broodstock. And it also includes more detailed information such as reasons for the project and the feasibility of the project, such as looking at the habitat and fish populations in the area, documentations of conditions that justify the project, such as low fish runs, and any communication or collaboration that is required of the applicant. Also, the applicant must include a management plan showing that the applicant can carry out and sustain the project, and a plan for fish propagation or repopulation in Alaska water. And finally, the applicant's goals, schedule, performance measures, scope of work, budget, data collection means, any genetics management that the applicant will require, and watershed habitat enhancement plan, if applicable. Subsection C requires that a project must meet certain standards before it is permitted. The first is that it may restore or introduce a population of fish where subsistence and escapement goals have not been met, or there have not been any goals established, and local stakeholders have identified a decline in the number of fish. This is one of the concerns that we've seen in some of the emails that we've received, that this permit can be used in any body of water in the state of Alaska, regardless of how healthy the fish runs are. This subsection C specifically states that this is not for fish runs. It's not for, you know, Bristol Bay, healthy fish runs, whether it's Kenai if it's healthy, or any of the Southeast fish runs. Really, it's for rivers that need it, that have seen a decline in the fish population. So it's not just any body of water in the state of Alaska. Also, the population of fish can be put in where the fish is limited or absent due to restricted accessibility due to a natural man-made barrier or other identified factor. And also, the applicant will have to show that this project will result in public benefits, and it will not introduce a non-indigenous fish or live fertilized eggs of non-indigenous fish in violation of AS 1635-210. And again, Madam Chair, that was another concern that we've heard from, that, you know, you're going to be putting a bunch of pike in the Kenai or down the Yukon, and it's going to destroy the natural salmon runs, which, again, it clearly states that if someone has a plan that they want to put pike in the Kenai, then it's going to be rejected. Subsection D creates a list of factors that the department must consider when reviewing an application. It's that list of factors includes the department's assessment of the project and whether or not it's consistent with the constitutional and statutory requirements to manage Alaska's fish resources for all people of Alaska as a public resource. It also requires the capabilities of the applicant to actually complete the project based on the application, the degree of reasonable communication that the applicant has done with stakeholders that may be affected by the project, both local and other experts, and public comments for the project, whether or not the project will increase scientific knowledge and understanding of the fish and the environment affected by the project. Subsection E requires that a permit holder must collect and provide to the Department of Fish and Game a reasonable amount of data that is requested. They must also reasonably communicate with affected stakeholders, both experts and local individuals and organizations. Subsection F allows a permit to be transferred to another person if they qualify for the permit. Subsection G sets a timeline that the department must follow in the adjudication process for each permit, and that consists of the commissioner must notify the applicant if their application is complete or not within 15 days after the application is turned in. This could,
excuse me for just one moment. Representative Millett.
Thank you. So under subsection H, you said that it's a transfer of the permit to another eligible person, correct?
I believe that was subsection F for Frank. Unless, is that perhaps in the older version?
Well, I'm looking at you. I'm just looking at your, through the chair. I'm looking through your sectional where it talks about H creates a new subsection, setting requirements for public notice and comment for a permit application. Mm-hmm. And then what I'm asking is the permit, it's transferable, but it's transferable through the Department of Fish and Game. And then you talked about adjudication. So who's doing your adjudication? Are you doing that? I'm assuming it's set up similar to CFAC. If you have a issue with the permit or someone doesn't agree with the transfer, doesn't agree with the denial or that it goes into some type of adjudication system, and that would be held under Fish and Game through the administrative hearing process. Is that what I'm seeing here?
Madam, through the chair, Representative Millett, so your question is, when someone wants to transfer a permit, does it go through a similar adjudication process as with commercial fishing permits?
So through the chair, what I'm asking for is, so the permits will be held in Department of Fish and Game, correct? Okay, so they're the ones that will be doing the transfer of the permit and transfer from another person to another person, or denying if they choose to, doesn't meet the qualifications. So if someone doesn't think that the Fish and Games, and normally what happens is if the Fish and Game denies a permit, the applicant for the permit has an opportunity to, what's the word I'm looking for?
Appeal
to the Fish and Game, and then who does that adjudication? Is it done by Fish and Game, or is it done by an outside source? Like CFEC is designed so you have an adjudication by attorneys, right? So where is your adjudication take place is all I'm really asking. And you can call Lifeline if you need to call. Deputy Commissioner Brooks up.
Madam,
I can hold my question.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, as the bill is written, there is not a appeal process. We wanted to make this permit a relatively simple permit that it either is complete and is a good project that Fish and Game will accept and give a permit, or it's not complete and it doesn't work and they reject it. And if it does get rejected, then ideally we want this to be a relatively simple permit process so that they can just go back, figure out what was missing in the application, and come back again. And if it's not complete, in the first 15 days, the department has to notify the applicant that if they're missing, evidence that say if they're missing what species of fish they want to use for a project, then the Department of Fish and Game will say, applicant Joe, you need to give us, here's your application back, send it back with what type of fish you're going to use. And that then they'll, after the department notifies the applicant that's not complete, that they're missing the species of fish that they want to use, the applicant will have 30 days to turn it back in before, if they don't turn it in within 30 days, then the commissioner will reject the application.
Follow up, please.
Thank you. So I understand the permit application process, but you're talking about a different process here. So it's a transfer of a existing permit. So that person wouldn't be filling out any of that. That's just, you're just saying, I want everything that's on this application. So you're giving up, you have a permit, and I like what you're doing, and you don't want to do it anymore, and you want to transfer your permit to me. And so we go through the transfer process. The Fish and Game denies me, and I want to appeal to the Fish and Game. Right, you already have the permit. I'm trying to get your permit. So I just want to know who adjudicates or how the process goes if someone is determined not eligible based on whatever, what their appeal process is. So it's I see it refers to Section K, and it's an individual business or government agency or any other legal. So, I'm business B, you're business A, you want to transfer the permit. I'm not going to go through the whole application process because you've already done that. I just want to transfer your permit to me. We go through the transfer process, and Commissioner Brooks says, Therese, you can't have one. And so what's the process after that? That's all I'm asking.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Millett, we didn't actually go beyond the our idea. I think our intent here is that that person that wants to acquire that permit has to qualify exactly like the permit holder. So the original permit application and that project plan, I think they would have to demonstrate to Fish and Game that they had the same ability as that person that originally had the permit and that project plan that they turned in to carry that out. So we really did just leave that entirely up to Fish and Game to make that approval.
Follow up. That sounds good. I imagine that Fish and Game could do regulations that would lay out the exact transfer process, and I can ask Commissioner Brooks when he gets up here.
Yeah, through the chair. Yeah, I think Commissioner Brooks probably answers that far better than I do. I know that we have they have an educational permit that that they have a similar process to, and I shouldn't assume anything because I know what assume means, but I would assume in this instance is they would probably follow those same type of guidelines.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Venture.
Thank you. And I'd like to acknowledge Representative Ortiz has just joined us. And I do have a question also. On E, it says, creates a new subsection requiring a permittee to collect and provide project data and reports requested by the department and to reasonably communicate with individuals affected by the project. Is there anywhere in here that defines reasonably?
Madam Chair, yes, it is in subsection L, and I can keep on going through the section, or I can just jump to that right now if you'd like.
No, please, just keep on going and we'll get there.
Okay.
Thanks.
So we were in subsection G with the timeline. So once the applicant turns in their application, the department will have 15 days to notify the applicant whether the application is complete or not. If it's incomplete, then the applicant will have 30 days to turn it back in with the missing information. Otherwise, the commissioner will deny the application. Within 60 days after the commissioner notifies that the application is complete, if it is complete, then they'll have 60 days to adjudicate the permit. And this is something that we're working on with Fish and Game. The exact number of days that we may, if needed, we're willing to adjust that just depending on what the department feels would be an appropriate timeline. So we're not hard and fast on the 60-day deadline. If the commissioner does not act, whether deny or accept the application for a permit, if they don't do that within 60 days, then the application is automatically approved and the department shall issue a permit. Subsection H deals with how the department will give public notice for a permit application. Public notice will have to be given within 15 days after the application is received. The department will do this by posting notice in regional and local offices and on the department's website. And we also added something in here that if an individual or an organization wishes to be notified by the department when someone applies for a project, then the department will email through electronic mail that they'll notify that individual, organization, or company and let them know there's this new project that this other organization has applied for. And following the notification, there'll be 30 days of public comment. Once the department decides, approves or rejects the application, they will have 30 days to provide public notice of that approval or denial of the application. subsection I, creates requirements that will be imposed on a person that has issued a permit. First is that the permit must preserve natural fish feeding behavioral patterns as much as possible. Second, if they do need to use supplemental nutrients, then the permit must obtain the biological components from indigenous sources in the state.
Question? Representative Millett.
Thank you. I hate to go on about regulations, but so when you're putting a biological agent in a stream, is that going to be something that is tested? I mean, my fear is introducing, especially with invasive species and things that we have with our lakes and streams, that we'd be introducing something foreign. So how do you verify that is it going to be something through DEC, or is Fish and Game going to verify that? What's your process for making sure the biological or whatever you're enhancing the food supply with is
Through the chair, Representative Millett, our intent is to have this process, the feeding patterns, to be reviewed by the Department of Fish and Game, and so they will determine whether the food is natural or is derived from natural sources. But they'll also, they can speak to that as well if they have some different information for that.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, also, we in the CS we've put a limit of 500,000 incubated or fertilized eggs or hatched fish that are allowed to be placed in state water. This is the primary differentiation between this new permit and what the current permit is. There was at least some concern that with this permit, the way it was originally written in the version that was introduced, that you could make a huge hatchery that releases millions of fish into the water, and that was not our intent at all. Our intent was to make a relatively small permit for small projects, and we believe that the 500,000 egg limit will be a good differentiation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heron.
On that section, I'll wait till Fish and Game is up, but I'd like to understand the science of that number a little more, but I'll wait.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, please.
And subsection 4 of section I, the permittee will be required to implement appropriate controls to avoid the introduction of non-indigenous or invasive pathogens, or to increase the indigenous pathogens beyond levels acceptable to the department. And this is put here so that the applicant will have to show that what they're doing to the stream will not introduce diseases that are unnatural to the body of water, that it won't increase any pathogens that are existent there, because that was a concern that we've heard, that what we're doing is the term is bucket biology, where just anybody that has $100 and is a resident of Alaska can just throw a bunch of fish into the water, and that's gonna very likely cause problems. We're doing the best we can with this permit, and to put the proper controls in place so that stuff like that doesn't happen. So you're not having a bunch of pike being thrown into the Kenai. You're not having a bunch of diseased fish being thrown in some of the headwaters of Bristol Bay. You're not going to have problems like that. So it's all going through the Department of Fish and Game. If they see proposed projects that are having problems, that the organization that's doing it doesn't have in place the proper risk mitigation so that diseases aren't introduced into a body of water. If they don't have that, then they're going to deny the permit. Subsection J requires the department to make information provided by the permittee public unless the information is confidential by law, and the department will need to make this information available for at least 6 months. And we wanted to put this in the permit because we wanted whatever scientific information we could gain from these permits, we wanted it to be public so that you're not having the possibility of a private organization or a private company using this information for their own personal profit, that it's for the benefit of the public, for the benefit of the Department of Fish and Game, so that we can hopefully figure out how to better enhance our fisheries in Alaska. And then subsection K requires that any fish released in the state water with this permit are available to the people for common use. And that's similar to a section within the hatchery permit, because there was concern that back in the 70s when those sections were put into statute, that you'd have private companies that would build their own private hatchery, and they would have a fish run that goes directly into their fish processing plant. And this is just a way to make sure that fish that, whether no matter what the project is, the fish that are released are our public resource, as our Constitution requires. In Section L is the definitions that are relevant to this bill. Number one is person, means an individual, corporation, business trust, estate, trust, partnership, limited liability, corporate company, association, joint venture, or government subdivision, agency, or instrumentality, public corporation, or another legal or commercial entity. Number two is a qualified person. Qualified person, which is the individuals that are allowed to apply for this permit. Qualified person means a state resident under AS 4323095, a corporation organized under laws of this state, and that includes non-profit corporations, or a corporation not organized under the laws of this state that collaborates with a state resident or corporation organized under the laws of this state. And we wanted to put that in there so you're not having large multinational or global corporations making these big projects or even these small projects without at least requiring them to work with local stakeholders, whether it's the native tribes that are local, conservation group, you name it, whatever local group, that so that it's not just so that we're able to have some local control on these projects. And the last definition is reasonably communicate, which means communicating significant information by a mode of communication likely to provide notice to persons a reasonable person would know are affected by a project or proposed project. And the intent that we had towards the definition is that we want an applicant to communicate with local stakeholders as much as possible, but we understand that even today with email and Facebook and vast modes of communication that you can communicate with millions of people in an instant, especially in rural Alaska where people are far off, spread apart, and it's a little more difficult to communicate even in today's world. We didn't want to make it so that you have to communicate with every single person that's affected, because it'd be very difficult to communicate with every single person that would be affected. So we're just trying to make it so that they reasonably communicate with people that are affected by it. If they know they're going to be affected, whether it's an organization or an individual, say an individual that lives off the Yukon River, that they're probably going to be affected by the project. So the applicant should try to communicate with that person.
Okay, we have a question here from Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an unusual subsection, 3. So if you were to read it in a different way, you would be saying reasonably communicate, which means an acceptable degree, and then after mode of communication, likely. What that means is chance that something will happen. And then the reasonable person, what it's saying is it has to be a rational person. So I get it, but boy, that's a mouthful there. And it's almost too complicated. No need to comment. Thanks.
Well, along those lines, I'm reading this, and I have the same concerns. I know I've been referred to as unreasonable, but I never saw it that way. So I think this leaves the door pretty wide open, and it could end up being a contentious situation, not to berate the issue, but, you know, you might want to wordsmith that a little bit.
Sure.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Joshua. Great presentation. So my question is, maybe that's a, because we all kind of, we had a little sidebar talking about just reasonably, defining reasonably in statute is interesting, because we talk about this a lot in the criminal statute. So my question is maybe, who was your attorney? Bullard was your attorney drafter. Maybe next meeting we could get him online, or maybe he could walk us through or send us a memo on in defining reasonably. It's just a term of art that reasonably is such a hard, you know. I mean, what's reasonable to me might not be reasonable to Louise, and might not be reasonable to Representative Ortiz or Representative Heron. So it would be just an interesting. Maybe we could elaborate on that a little bit.
Thank you. I think we have one more section. Section two. Did you do that?
Not yet, Madam Chair, but okay. Briefly, Section 2, under 1605-871, it requires if a company or organization has a construction project that or any other project that could have the potential of affecting a salmon population nearby, they have to show to the Department of Fish and Game that what they're doing that is not going to affect the fish population, or that they're within the project, that they're going to do their best to not harm the fish. And so what Section 2 does is when a construction company that they're building a new road close to the Yukon River, when they're building the road, if that same company applies for efficient fisheries enhancement permit, that the fact that they have a permit will be used as a consideration towards that construction company protecting and ensuring that they don't have any harm towards the fish population on the Yukon River. So it'll be a part of it can be used as a part of a fish protection plan for a company that's doing a project.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Banks. That was a nice presentation. Do we have any questions from this committee? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that you have a couple of attached letters in your presentation. One from the Bellingham Technical College talking about how they've used moist air incubation in the past, evidently successfully, or you wouldn't have put it in the letter or in the packet. To what level has there been use of this type of technology in the lower 48 or around the world, and has there been any record or any problems associated with moist air incubation process? Has there been any areas where it hasn't worked out so well?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, one of the invited testimony individuals is Brian Ashton, who has worked with these two colleges and has worked with the Chickaloo Native Tribe for successful use of the moist air incubator, and I believe he'd be a better person to answer that question, to see if there is any any negative views. So if, Madam Chair, if you, we can wait for Mr. Ashton's testimony, or if the chair would like him to come up now.
We'll wait until we make sure we don't have any more questions from this committee. Thank you. Representative Kreis-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question relating to the sustainability of Alaska's commercial fisheries. And as you may know, this has been an ongoing saga with Alaska's commercial fisheries and whether they're certified sustainable. And the various certification regimes look closely at enhancement and hatcheries as, I guess, a metric or consideration for that sustainability certification. Are you familiar with what aspects of enhancement relate to these sustainability certification evaluations or reviews? And do you have a sense of how this bill, given that it relates to enhancement, might relate to these outside groups that are reviewing the sustainability of our commercial fisheries?
Madam Chair, Representative Kreis-Tompkins, that may be another question that Mr. Ashton can address. But a lot of these qualifications and requirements of this application are similar to the current hatchery process, and that can be something that the Department of Fish and Game can address as well if the chair would like them to testify as to why our hatcheries are to the best that we can are sustainable and aren't causing the same problems that we're seeing in some of the lower 48 that I think some of these organizations are really going after. I believe there'd be some other folks that could answer that question even further.
Okay, thank you. Representative Millett.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Tallarico and Mr. Banks, for bringing this bill. I'm always interested in increasing fisheries as a retired commercial fisherwoman. The fluctuation sometimes in runs and anything we can do to enhance that or diminish the fluctuation for me is a good thing. I have a question on your fiscal note, and it might be more. You might know the answer, Mr. Banks, or I can talk to Fish and Game when they get up here. So we have taken three mariculture positions out of Fish and Game. My question is I see this bill as a pretty big enhancement tool, but I also see that with the risk of some of the things you're proposing, which I don't think are bad, but just acknowledging that the risks of putting, food back in, enhancing the food source and those things like that. I would imagine for me, because the stocks are so valuable and the fish is so valuable, that changing any type of changing of the fish stock or patterns of the fish that could be detrimental are always a risk for me when I see anything like this. So the fiscal note says it has little or no impact, and the department's going to look at absorbing those costs. But I can see this program really, if it works well, of really being a tool in our toolbox that would enhance a natural resource, that all Alaskans own, that could be good. But my fear is that we institute a piece of legislation like this, and I guess I'd like to get a good feeling about, how intensive, and have you had the conversation with Fish and Game, especially with reductions to the mariculture, that they could handle a program of this size? Because it has a zero fiscal note, and that's what I want to point. I like that it has a zero fiscal note, but I want to just true up that to make sure that we're not putting more pressures on Fish and Game than they can do right now.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I think that probably the department could better answer that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Well, we appreciate your presentation, and we will move on to testimony, and we will first have our invited testifiers. So at that point, I will open up public testimony with having our invited testifiers first. And we have Brian Ashton.
Good morning. My name is Brian Ashton. I live in Wrangell, Alaska. And I've never done this before, so I'm a little nervous. And Bob, I may look familiar to you because I used to be in Bethel in the 80s working for the fire department. I was asked to come here to speak about my experience with restoring wild salmon. I've been a lifelong Alaskan. I got involved in hatchery management back in 89 and 90. And I'm not a biologist. I'm more of an operations person. And it was a very fascinating experience to go back to Southeast where I'd grown up in Hoonah and see what was being done in enhancing wild stocks, using wild stocks for the successful hatchery programs we have now in Alaska. But one of the things that I realized as I looked at this with fresh eyes is two things. The hatcheries have definitely taken the dips out of our commercial fisheries and stabilized our economy. And, of course, with oil money going away, it's never been more important to make sure that we preserve our salmon runs, but especially our wild salmon runs, because over the years now, since I've developed this technology, but really focus more on designing the methodology, which then basically pushed me towards developing technologies to support the methodology of restoring wild salmon. I just realized that, like in the lower 48, where they started having listed stocks, the salmon will become endangered and listed. And the National Marine Fisheries would come in and basically say, you have a stock of concern, you can't catch it. What are you going to do to not catch it? In the middle of catching a bunch of other fish that are fine. And it really made me concerned that if we ever had stocks of fish start getting listed in Alaska and they said, you know, keep on catching the other fish if you can without catching that listed stock, I went, that's impossible to do. And so as a means to preserve the wild salmon, I became focused on the idea of what can we do to help wild salmon survive and at the same time make sure that we preserve the nature of the wild salmon. In the lower 48, I found that when a stock became listed, they enacted what's called a captive brood program, where they'll take those last few fish, they'll take them out of the river system, and they'll actually raise them in a hatchery environment in a fish farm all the way to maturation to get the eggs out, because of their idea was that you needed to protect that fish all the way through. And in essence, my perspective on that is that you had to domesticate that fish in order to save it. And I went, isn't there more of a middle road here, a more conservative approach we can take? And so in your attachment, you'll see just basically a picture. A picture is worth 1,000 words for me. And you can see where in a wild salmon, in the case of a king salmon, you can have 5,000 eggs that come back in a female. And it's gone through the entire life cycle of the fish in the ocean, either be eaten. It's come back to spawn. And when that fish does spawn, you know, you can see 5 to 10% fertilization of those eggs. So out of 5,000 eggs, you see 250 eggs actually get fertilized. And so my assessment of hatchery operations is to recognize when we can step in and help these natural stocks survive better while preserving their natural diversity, the genetics, the genetic patterns of behavior that you can't basically identify through markers. Science doesn't allow us to yet. So, in essence, the approach that I took was to go in, if you have a stock that needs help, and to intercept the male and female in the river that they chose to go to, manually fertilize the eggs, because the hatchery technology and operations that we have today in Alaska are very, very sound operations. You know, we can conservatively get 95% fertilization by doing this, and at the earliest stage possible, put those eggs right back into the creek. And ideally, put them back into the creek at a point where they never know they left. You've just simply enhanced those fish, that those eggs that actually had made it back, and they're wild. They have to eat or be eaten. At the same time, you've just simply increased survival of the fish. So my focus has been to basically promote this as a very powerful tool to protect our wild salmon for the day when we have fish that maybe can become listed. Or in this case, the very real reality that we have a lot of discrete subpopulations of salmon that already are in trouble. The watershed in your neck of the woods just above the hatchery there with king salmon. We have the Bradfield River near Wrangell, that was decimated by logging practices in the 60s, and the watershed never came back to a large degree. And the fishermen still talk about it today, about how amazing those fish were, and it's too bad we don't have them today. The fact that on Andrews Creek in the Stikine River, there was some pretty high interception in the mid-2000s, and basically there was no subsistence fishing in the last 3 or 4 years to let that fish run come back. I realized that we needed to find a way to be as proactive about helping our fish survive as we are in catching them. But I would also like to recognize the fact that this is not to imply that the fish and game has not done a spectacular job over the last 40 and 50 years, because it's a very difficult job that they have, and that the escapement management process is very, very effective. But it cannot catch all those discrete subpopulations of fish. And when we basically have to stop fishing on a bigger stock of fish because we have one discrete subpopulation that's in trouble, like the I just went brain dead on the river system just above Bethel, the
Tuluksac
River is an example. If the community can basically be trained up in working with state and federal managers to go in and be employed to go in there on a grassroots level and enhance those eggs, then you basically don't have to have this devastating effect of shutting the whole system down because of one discrete subpopulation. So that's the intent of the process. So what this really does is this is also not new operations in Alaska. We're not actually introducing a new process. What we're doing, and I was asked to weigh in on this, to basically advise on helping put together a process to recognize the fact that there needs to be an intermediary permit process to be able to do this. So this is not new. This is already being done in the state. The other thing I'd like to recognize is the fact that this, when I read the bill, I'm in support of the bill firmly establishing the controls that Alaska Department of Fish and Game has developed over the decades for genetics management, or to make sure that people are not introducing invasive species. There's so many areas that we have to be super critical and conservative about to make sure that we do protect those wild fish, because in essence, that's what this is about. Is finding a tool that we can actually go in and help protect our wild fish. And as an example, if we do get a stock listed in Alaska someday, and the National Marine Fisheries comes in and says, if you have a plan, we will stay out of it. We'll monitor the plan. Do you have a plan? This becomes a very, very powerful tool to say, we have a plan, and we've been developing the plan, developing the capacity of this plan, so we're ready to address that discrete subpopulation that's in trouble. And National Marine Fisheries basically says, okay, we'll monitor it. Keep on fishing. Good job. The other thing that I've realized being a lifelong Alaskan is that it's really important. I take it very seriously that we need to have stakeholder involvement in management, and we need to have residents involved in management. And a big part of achieving that is making sure that we actually have educated people involved in our fisheries and fisheries management. And one of the things that I see from this process by involving people under state management is basically raising the bar and people's awareness of the life cycle of the fish, basically how important it is to preserve the fish, to adhere to management plans that communities basically buy into and help collaborate on designing and developing. So this really basically is a very comprehensive approach to understanding these wild fish as well. So there's a lot more to be realized from simply helping the fish meet their minimum escapement goals. The community benefits as a whole in understanding the fisheries process and the education. And there's more I can say, but I think at that point I'd like to stop and just ask if there's any questions. And I'll be sitting back here if you have any more questions for me to answer. Representative Ortiz, you did have a question? Maybe I could answer.
Excuse me. Mr. Ashton, we appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions for this gentleman from the committee?
I have some questions, but I think they might be better suited for the Fish and Game folks. They are going to testify,
they are here for questions, so certainly. Mr. Ashton, you are very eloquent in your testimony. Thank you. Do you happen to have written testimony that you could submit to this committee?
I haven't drafted anything else up. What I did was, in case there was some discussions about how this relates to existing hatcheries, I provided Representative Tallarico with a definition page that you guys have a copy of, I believe. But I can provide more information to you very shortly if you'd like.
That might be useful. Okay. If you could do that. We would appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question. You used the term, your project is trying to enhance the wild salmon stocks. Is that correct? Okay. Can you define, can you give me a definition of wild salmon and how your process that this bill proposes, the process of salmon enhancement, how it differs from the hatchery process in terms of why yours would enhance wild salmon stocks and how the hatchery process doesn't do that, that those are hatchery raised fish. You see what I'm saying? I guess what I'm saying is, give me a definition of what wild salmon is for you.
Personally, wild salmon for me is a fish that basically has to go out into the wild and survive on its own through its entire life cycle. That's my own personal definition. There are people that say if you ever touch a fish, it's no longer wild. A lot of people will contest that that means that we're not part of the process. I had an elder when I was in Huna actually introduce this concept to me and basically say, we used to go into the creeks, make sure there was nothing in the way of the fish making it back to the spawning grounds, and if the fish didn't come back in the numbers that we felt were sustainable, in other words, they actually knew about escapement way back when, they would actually go in and capture the males and females, manually fertilize the eggs, and bury those eggs back into the gravel in cedar baskets. So they understood this concept that if there wasn't enough, help the eggs that made it back survive, so there is enough escapement, basically. So my personal view of wild salmon is that we can help them survive, certainly to a little bit when you look at how much we actually utilize them. We're very good at killing them. But to be very, very cognizant of a lot of the science that we don't yet know. There's no way to genetically define a pattern of behavior for a fish. You can look at genetic markers for the fish scale is blue, or it's this big. And certainly there's a lot of frankenfish issues that are going on. Sorry if that's politically incorrect, GMO fish, where people are manipulating those types of things. And it's a very big concern because we have some very pristine wild salmon that we would like to maintain as wild. My personal operational philosophy was when the fish comes out of the gravel, it doesn't know it left. Or if you simply have to put the fry back into the river system that it came from, and it's important to notice to say that it goes back into the watershed that it came from, that you do it as quickly as you possibly can. You don't feed it food that it doesn't, that it didn't naturally eat. And at that point, you just simply have to say, yep, there's going to be a lot of mortality at this point, but we've done a lot to get you further than you are. We took 5,000 eggs and put 4,000 eggs back in instead of 250. But at this point, you need to go on your own and carry yourself out because you are supposed to be a wild fish. So that's my philosophy as far as where the line is in the sand, if you will. And that is my own personal philosophy.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Ashton. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And we have Will Mayo here from the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Please identify yourself and who you represent.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Mayo. I have provided written testimony, and I will stick fairly close to it, but you have that, and I may add some ad lib comments as I go, if that's okay. My name is Will Mayo. I am the Executive Director of Tribal Government and Client Services for the Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. We're commonly referred to as TCC. TCC is made up of the 42 communities in the interior that stretch from Eagle to Holy Cross, which was about 750 miles, and from Arctic Village to McGrath between the major mountain ranges. And we have the Yukon River drainage, the Kuskokwim drainage that our villages are a part of, and the Tanana River. And so we have a stake in what occurs here and with this bill and what it proposes to do. Our member communities live first and foremost on a subsistence economy. And I use that term sometimes to differentiate, only to differentiate between that and the cash economy. So I currently live in Fairbanks, and I live predominantly on the cash economy. But when I live in my village of Tanana, I live primarily on a subsistence economy. So most of my family sustenance comes from the land and the waters when I live in my village. That's simply because there are not the cash economy opportunities there. So our villages in their local economies range from lows of, say, Circle, or correction, well, I won't name them, just a small village of $4,500 a year to a very successful cash economy village would be a $60,000 a year community, and that would be a larger community such as Galena. Fort Yukon is a large community, and their mean income is around $17,000 a year. So as you can see, these are not numbers that would sustain a family. So living off the land is an essential. It's a very ancient, what you call a livelihood, a tradition. Whatever labels you want to put on it, it's just the way it is. And so living off the land is the true source of food security in these communities. And whenever those food sources are endangered, challenged, that's a great concern. And you can see why. And I'll continue. So historically, 60% of the diet in these communities is derived from salmon. And specifically from Chinook or king salmon. We also have a lot of chum, but these chum aren't of the same quality when they reach our areas. We also have the silver salmon, which are of good quality and are favored or highly prized, but they come very late in the season. And so the traditional methods for preserving and processing are not available. So they, while they are able to freeze them, they cannot process them in the traditional manner that people love. So that's because they come late in the season and it's colder and wetter weather. So in recent years, the kings have declined alarmingly to the point that our member communities have even self-imposed a moratorium on harvesting kings. Even though the Department of Fish and Game might have given an opening, our people refused to do it on the basis that the more we allowed through, the more chance we have of recovery. So we've made every effort conceivable to try to address this issue, and to the point of declining to harvest even when opportunities were there. And in times like that, in recent years, we have not been meeting escapement goals for the king salmon on the Yukon River drainage. This year, we met the minimum goals and exceeded it by, say, 18,000 fish or 20,000 fish, a minimal escapement surplus. but it was an encouraging trend that we hope to see will continue. So we have also, this last season, our fishermen worked cooperatively with ADF&G in-season managers to make all necessary measures to increase escapement, agreeing to stringent and management actions and limitations, and even encouraging it and working closely. The level of concern is extremely high in these communities. The commitment to recovery is total among our rural communities. So, I'm from the village of Tanana, and my father is from Rampart, and I have relatives in Stevens Village and also Minto, and so we're spread out all along the center of all of this. And as a child, I can remember fish camps all along the river, very busy hanging and drying fish. I was traveling the river extensively this summer, last summer, and saw these camps vacant and the drying racks empty and the smokehouses unused. And this is an unbelievable thing for us. To see very little traffic on the river, to see these camps growing up with willows and weeds. Towards the end of the season, we began to see activity because the silvers came. And some people still catch the some of the fish for dogs, the fish that are run out, and they don't consider the quality for eating fish. So it's quite a shock to travel the river and see that. Under the direction of our tribes, TCC has been an active participant with the ongoing fisheries management systems in our state, federal and state systems. And we take full advantage of those processes, regulatory, statutory, and we are honing our skills in these areas by training people for full participation. So we are active participants in that, in close interaction with the federal and state managers. We created a Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission to more closely focus and address these issues. We participate in the Yukon River Panel, which is part of the Pacific Treaty or Agreement. And the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. We also do scientific data collection and projects with our own in-house biologists and with our local communities who participate in collection of data. And so we're amassing information and we're honing our abilities and skills in these areas. We're not waiting for permission or asking for permission. And in fact, nobody's requiring permission of us. We are simply moving into these areas of building our capacity and our competency in the science. So we have highly qualified people who are a part of our team. And as I say, we partner and work closely with existing systems. One area that we want to work on is developing capacity in recovery and enhancement programs. We don't want hatcheries. We're not interested in hatcheries because we don't consider those to be wild. We want to maintain and sustain the wild nature of our stocks. Our community is not interested in changing that. So we are looking at minimally invasive processes that enhance, not replace. We don't want to introduce that kind of science into our processes. We believe that the fish, when they emerge from the gravels, from the alevin stage, and they emerge as fry from the gravels of these creeks, that they must begin to make their own way. And when they deal with the nature of their environment, they grow strong, they get healthy, they survive because they do that. So we aren't nurturing them into sizes through tanks or through artificial feeding. That's not what we're interested in, and that is why this technology is interesting to us. We're not ready to fully endorse anything until we have seen our own successes, and we want to work with the best biological science available to proceed and to develop these tools. So we have no interest in endangering our fisheries. We have no interest whatsoever in doing anything. So we will, if anything, be more stringent and more demanding on standards than state or federal biologists. So we are very conservative in these matters. So I want to close, Madam Chair, but I just want to point out that that we believe that these opportunities, a wonderful opportunity was given for many of our road communities with the Gulkana Hatchery Program. I only talk about the hatchery program because it provides wonderfully for the road communities and including Anchorage, Fairbanks, and any Alaskan that can access that easily on the road through the Chitna dip net fishery, including the commercial fishery out at the mouth of the Copper River. And so we see that as having provided a wonderful fishery and opportunity for many Alaskans to participate in annually. And we believe that there is also opportunities for enhancement and recovery of Yukon River stocks that can be utilized along with the escapement model to address to more closely and directly address specific subspecies enhancement efforts. Escapement goals, there's a broad model, and it works, but it has its limits, and we think that this has promise for more closely honing in on a need. The bill provides a structure, and this is what is very important that we see in it. To the state's permitting system that is fair to everyone, it allowing proposals to move forward while providing assurance that sound scientific processes are preserved. And that's really what we want. We're not interested in messing around. We're not interested in stomping around and throwing fish here and there. We really are interested in solid methods. So this bill is important, we believe, to providing a vehicle and a structure that will enable us to move forward. Finally, we aren't talking about hatcheries. I said that. Over the years, we have seen drops in different subspecies, such as in the 90s, we had the crash of the fall chum salmon. The result of that is still felt today when many of our communities suffered in that, and now we're seeing this with the king salmon. So we want to be effective partners in recovery efforts. That's the bottom line, working hand in hand with state managers to develop tools that work. In these times of financial challenge, it makes good sense to work together utilizing affordable technology breakthroughs that can be scientifically applied under stringent controls and sound biology to aid in recovery efforts. So the CS to HB 220 is a big step in the direction of sound scientific practices applied to discrete subspecies recovery efforts, and I speak in favor of this bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you kindly for your testimony, excellent testimony. Do we have any questions from this committee? Representative Millett.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, Mr. Mayo. Your presentation encapsulated every thought that I've had about this bill, that it could be a real tool for Alaskans, not only the interior. I mean, it has ramifications for the Kenai, for all the places around the state, more so impactful for you because you live in a more rural and you area and rely on fish for subsistence and cultural reasons, which I understand. And I think you spoke really eloquently about the bill. Do you share some of the concerns I have about introducing feeding the stock? And I know that Representative Tallarico's done a great job of making sure that it's a natural food. What I'm worried about, while I think that the communities surrounding your region would be very careful to do that, my fear is that in other places, I fished in Bristol Bay, so I could see, you know, enhancing the stocks in a way that might not be the best quality of fish. I, too, am a fish snob. I don't like to go down the Seward and get the hatchery fish. Not that they're bad, it's just a choice, right? So I want to make sure that we have the most organic wild salmon that we can possibly have, that's the less human hands touch it or do anything to damage that stock or that species is what I'm truly interested in. But I also understand that, you know, fish are dying and runs are low and we absolutely have to do something. It's one of our biggest and best natural resources. It was born from the state. It's the original resource development and sustainability. So do you have concerns about that? And can you talk through the Tanana Chief's process? Do you have a process in place right now for your streams and rivers on enhancing through more organic types of food and food delivery?
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Millett, did I say it right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The questions that our biologists posed to us have so far been tougher than any that we have fielded. And as I sit in my staff meetings, and those biologists serve under my department, I encourage them, put it all out there, be hard, be tough. And first of all, we don't anticipate participating in any efforts that involve feeding. We firmly believe that these fish must emerge as fry into their natural habitat. Those are our parameters. We are not considering any other types of efforts. We certainly are not considering any kind of feeding program. So we share the same concerns. We believe in minimally invasive processes that Mr. Ashton outlined for you, that are proven technologies from the old Tlingit methodologies that he has adapted with modern tools. And so we think that is an attractive option that we want to look into some more.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Mayo, for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have several people online that would like to testify, and I'm going to ask, for the sake of expediency, if you'll keep your testimony to 3 minutes, and I'm going to take them slightly out of order because we have a couple of testifiers that are on a time restraint here. So the first one I'm going to take is off-net, Sarah O'Neill from Seattle, the University of Washington. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sarah O'Neill, and I'm a biologist at the University of Washington. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. As I said, I'm calling from Seattle, Washington, where I'm currently working on my PhD, but I have worked as a salmon ecologist for nearly 20 years now throughout the West Coast, including Oregon, Washington, D.C., and then finally, most recently, in Alaska, where I moved to focus my efforts as a self-employed consultant several years ago after becoming convinced that there's just nowhere else on this side of the Pacific Ocean anyway where we can still maintain healthy, wild, self-sustaining salmon populations like we have in Alaska. All we need to do in order to maintain those populations is to maintain the high standards that Alaska has already crafted for managing commercial fisheries and to develop our resources carefully and conscientiously and, frankly, to avoid establishing new hatcheries. We have learned the hard way down here in the lower 48 that hatcheries actually cause more problems than they solve. They just aren't the band-aid that we thought that they would be, and in fact don't enhance fisheries but actually hurt them. They continue to operate down here largely with the purpose of meeting treaty obligations, which they are doing poorly, judging by the amount of finger-pointing and anger between tribes and commercial and sport fishermen here. Some of the reasons that hatcheries have systematically failed and actually compounded lower 48 salmon collapses include increased diseases that are introduced into wild populations by hatchery salmon. Hatchery salmon compete in both fresh and salt water with wild salmon for food and for space. And in some cases, hatchery salmon have actually been documented as eating wild fish because they tend to grow bigger, so they'll just directly prey upon them. Hatchery releases also attract predators that prey additionally on wild fish. That's gotten so out of control down here that we're now spending millions of dollars a year to kill and harass native birds like cormorants and marine mammals like sea lions. Overharvest of wild stocks tends to co-occur with hatchery production because hatchery fish will intermingle with wild stocks and commercial fishermen end up inadvertently targeting those fish. And because, just in general, hatchery fish are frankly not as smart as wild fish. They just don't survive as well in the wild. They get lost and on their return to the rivers and end up in rivers where managers never intended them to be in the first place. But enough of them do survive to interbreed with wild fish, which ultimately spreads those less than smart genes throughout the population and decreases the overall fitness of wild salmon population.
Thank you. I'm going to have to ask you to sum it up. We have several people that are in line to testify.
Okay. Ultimately, increasing hatchery production is opening up a Pandora's box, which we simply cannot undo, and Alaska has the opportunity. It's the last place that has the opportunity to get it right by just leaving well enough alone.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Quick question, Madam Chair. So I take your testimony to be then that you're not in support of this proposal that we're hearing before us today. Is that correct?
You are correct. I do not support this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Lindsay Bloom?
Lindsay Bloom, I live here in Juneau. I work for a project called Salmon State. I'm a fisheries consultant, but I'm testifying just on my own behalf today. And I will admit that I came in after having read this bill and saw lots of red flags in it. I see that some of them were addressed in the CS that we were provided with today, but I appreciate that you're going to hold on to it and keep asking questions. And I've learned a lot just by listening to the testimony. And that said, I own a fishing permit here in Southeast Alaska. Lots of our fisheries are enhanced and supported by enhancement, so it's something that generally I'm interested in, benefit from, and appreciate that our state has done incredibly carefully, as opposed to what the last speaker was just talking about in the lower 48, where they've had massive problems and hatcheries have been managed at great detriment to wild fish. I think one thing that hasn't come up is the, you know, the beautiful thing about salmon is that they're anadromous, and so we've talked a lot today and heard a lot today about impacts that might or might not happen in freshwater. But one of the concerns overall about hatcheries, and that we have to, or you guys behind me have to sort of balance and manage as fisheries managers, is the carrying capacity of oceans. So what might work in a tributary stream, you know, might not, you know, we need to look, and I'd like to hear from more experts with ADF&G in terms of what's going on in the ocean and what we need to be thinking about there. Another thing just on that line that I'm a little bit worried about in the bill is, while I understand it's designed to keep projects small, like, I'd like to see some parameters for how many small projects you can have in one system. I don't know if it's like per stream or per river, but I could imagine 500,000 fish growing to be a lot bigger if you had many of these projects along the Yukon or another river. And I'd like to understand more about that, or maybe dial that in the bill. A little bit more. I'm really concerned about the automatic granting of the permit within 60 days. I was just thinking, I mean, if the department were to receive, you know, 10, 20, 30, 100 applications in 1 month, it does not seem reasonable to me that they would have to respond in 60 days or, you know, forever grant the application. I think that needs to be changed and fixed.
If you could sum it up, please.
Okay. I have just several more questions about the bill that I want answered, or I'd like to hear answers to, so I think I'll put that in written testimony to your office and see if we can address it further.
Great, so, and I will make sure that it gets to all the committees and the sponsor of the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll now go to Kodiak, and we have Alexis Quacha.
Madam Chairman, members of the Commission, just to keep it short, as the bill stands today, I'm a no vote.
If you could identify yourself, please, for the record.
Alexis Kwachka.
Thank you.
Representing myself.
I guess that was, and that's the end of your testimony?
That's it.
Okay, thank you. As long as we're in Kodiak, Chris Burns.
Madam Chairman, committee members, I'm not opposed to this.
Could you please identify yourself for the record?
Chris Burns.
Thank you.
Kodiak, Alaska. I'm not opposed to this bill. I don't understand why they just don't form a regional aquaculture committee. They could do that with the vote of their commercial permit holders up there, like we've done in Kodiak. Other than that, if this is if they can't do that for some reason, you know, for fish enhancement in the area, this bill just isn't fleshed out well enough. Reading through it, and it seems like there's contradictions in it, and there's a little bit of strange pandering, like the nutrients have to be made in the state. You know, I mean, usually when you add nutrients, you just buy phosphorus and nitrogen and the same stuff they put on the agricultural fields in the lower 48 or wherever. You know, I mean, it's just like you don't want to straitjacket yourself to actually do a project. You know, and if they're talking about, you know, just removing beaver dams or something for enhancement, I'm all for that, and everybody should be. And then there'd be the funding issue. I mean, who's going to fund this? Is it going to be, Tanana Chiefs? Are they going to fund it? There's just a lot of questions here. The aquaculture associations have access to the Fisheries Enhancement Revolving Loan Fund, so it, you know, to start projects, and that would be a question, you know, is where's the funding for these projects going to come from, and then, you know, like people have been talking, it could be applied in other areas in the state. Here in Kodiak, we've been trying to do projects through the Regional Aquaculture Association here, and it's really hard to do it with an established corporation that is funding and has funding abilities through cost recovery. So there's a lot of stuff here, and it's almost, I guess I'll wrap it up. It's almost like, for some reason, this bill is trying to reinvent the wheel. And I'll close on that. And I'm not against this. It's really interesting concept. I first thought it was a middle, you know, somewhere in the middle between a private nonprofit and a regional aquaculture association, some kind of a mechanism to get there for a smaller entity, you know. One other thing is that I don't think individual people should get these permits. I think it should be an entity, and then that gets rid of the permit transferring from a person to a person, because we can change our...
Thank you, Mr. Burns. We need you to wrap it up, please.
Okay, and get the permit stays the same to the association, and I'll be out then.
Thank you, and we appreciate your testimony. We'll go to Joel Randup in Petersburg. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, good afternoon, almost anyway, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joel Randrup. I'm a commercial fisherman in Petersburg, representing just myself. At this time, I don't support this bill. I believe that fisheries management should stay within the Department of Fish and Game and not the general public as described by the bill there, or qualified persons as stated. The state of Alaska is a success story concerning our fish management. I don't want to see us mess that up. I understand problems with the stream in the interior, but I believe that we should keep the management and the hands-on nuts and bolts of that management within the fish and game. And there's need for any stream enhancement or anything that should be kept up in the department itself. I believe the bill, as written, also adds a cost of doing business to the department that is already being cut. Or looking at cuts, and as it was brought up before, we got 3 maricultural positions cut out of the budget. I think I'd leave you with just that if there's a problem that we feel with the fish, then we should maybe allocate resources back into the department and have more of a hands-on with this and not leave it so wide open as the bill is stated. So thank you very much for your opportunity to comment on this.
Thank you for calling in. We appreciate your testimony. And our last testifier today will be Nancy Hillstrand from Kachemak Bay. Nancy, if you're there, please identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, my name is Nancy Hillstrand. I'm the owner of a 52-year-old fisheries corporation called Pioneer Alaskan Fisheries, and I also worked for Fred Division from 1978 to 1999 in hatcheries and stream rehabilitation. I believe this bill is well-intentioned, but once we open the door, it will be almost impossible to close. Opening this door would unleash even more fish wars beyond our comprehension. It's easy to understand the desire and zeal to just add fish, but I think it's really not easy for people to understand that just adding fish comes with a risk and consequence to our wild, natural, indigenous populations. We need to focus on self-sustaining habitats, and these come free to us if we recognize them as a free service that Mother Nature provides for us and for our fish. Consequences do and have happened. The factory pink and chum hatcheries that we have right now are coming under question to maybe these are causing a problem to our wild king salmon and red salmon, and I think we need to look at that as maybe we have a problem with that and as an underlying cause and a limiting factor to some of our other wild fish. The Fisheries Society, the American Fisheries Society, is a very old... It's the oldest and largest, most influential professional organization. And I'm just going to read a couple things that they stated. They study these things and have studied them for decades. And they had a symposium last year called the Hatchery versus Wild Salmonid symposium. They open with this statement. One of the most controversial and hot topics in fisheries biology today is the interaction between hatchery and wild salmon. To address and better understand these interactions, fisheries managers and researchers are reevaluating how hatchery programs are managed, if these programs may be contributing to the decline of wild populations. They also go on and state that as this relationship becomes better understood, there's a growing need to inform policymakers, resource managers, recreational, tribal, and commercial fishing communities, and the general public on the importance of wild populations. They prescribe understanding the limitation of hatchery origin fish and stocking programs. They emphasize that maintaining healthy habitat is critical, not only to maintaining viable self-sustaining natural populations, but also to adequately controlling the risks of hatchery programs. I think it's extremely important that we look into the science and to look into the literature that we have right now that's been, from what it looks like, 75% of the literature has been created in the last 10 years on some of these risks and consequences to our natural stocks. So to add a bill like House Bill 220, which opens a further door into possible damage to our wild stocks, I think we really need to sit back and really take time to learn the science before we make any further problems into our ecosystem than we already have. So in closing, I also feel as though this will be a huge burden on the state in cost, because monitoring is also...
Hey, I need you to sum it up, please.
Yes, I think we have to look at how much cost it will cost to monitor and make sure that we do these programs correctly. So I'm against this bill, and I thank you very much for the opportunity.
And thank you for your testimony. Are there any further questions from this committee? Right. Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And there's no further business to come before this committee today. We will meet again on Thursday, January 28th. There'll be two presentations, one from the Young Fishermen's Summit and the other from Southeast Alaska Regional Guides Association on regional quota entities and catch proposals. And we will take this bill up again at a meeting in the future. Thank you, and this meeting will be adjourned at 12:04.